Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
Hello and welcome, I'm Matt Everett and this is The First Time, where we speak to some of music's most influential figures about the pivotal first moments that shaped their lives and their careers, the events and songs that led them to be who and where they are today. Some albums just perfectly encapsulate their time, but also transcend it. Some records arrive at the right time, with the right songs played by the right band. The Lexicon of Love by ABC is one of those records. And as Six Music is celebrating the musical culture and history of Sheffield this weekend, it makes sense to welcome singer with the city's 80s pop heroes ABC, Martin Fry. Here Martin talks about his musical life growing up around punk, as the British music scene evolved into post-punk and then the high-concept, super-stylized pop scene of the 80s. He also discusses the birth of ABC and their run of huge singles like The Look of Love, Tears Are Not Enough, When Smokey Sings, and the song you just heard, Poison Arrow, a top 10 hit for ABC in 1982. And I started by asking Martin, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
I was first aware of music, I'd say, like a bolt out of the blue, David Bowie put his arm around Mick Ronson on Liftoff with Aisha. I recently learnt the date. I think it's May the 3rd, 1972, but I might be wrong. And he was performing Starman. And at that point in time, I thought, this is it.
Was that the ground zero moment?
That was the road to Damascus, yes.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. Was laying down some rock and roll, that is all he said. Then the loud sound it seemed to fade, came back like a slow voice on a wave of fade. That weren't no DJ, that was hazy cosmic ties. There's a starman waiting in the sky. Sky. He's told us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile.
sparkle, he may land tonight. Don't tell your papa or he'll get us locked up in fight. There's a star.
What was it? Was it the glamour as well as the music? Tell me about that formative point.
Well, Bowie, I mean, he affected a whole generation, and I was one of them. It's his commitment, I think. He was the star man. Yeah, totally. It was just something that transported me from the suburb of Manchester, Bramall, where I lived, just to another world. And I realised there and then, as a kid, as a tiny, tiny kid, that the power of music, yeah, definitely. But I have had many, many great euphoric moments through the years. But that was definitely one of the first.
What about the first record that you owned, the first thing that was yours that you could play whenever you wanted?
I have two answers to the first record I owned. One is the truth and one is the hip version. And
I want usually both. I want both.
Well, I usually tell people it was Voodoo Child. After Jimi Hendrix died, they put out Voodoo Child and it went to number one, and I do have a 7-inch vinyl copy of that record. And you know, Voodoo Child, I still play, not that version, but I still listen to that piece of music, Voodoo Child parts 1 and 2, and I can't fathom it out. I just think it's an incredible piece of music. But the actual first record I actually bought with a record token my grandma gave me was Mike and Bernie Winters, That Man Batman. And Innskeeper. It was a double A-side comedy record. But let's just say Hendrix.
And in terms of when you first start to go to gigs, when you first start to go and see bands, can you remember seeing any particular sort of performer and just thinking, that's what I want to be doing?
Well, being an old fella, I was very, very fortunate in 76 to go to the Lesser Free Trade Hall in Manchester and see a bill that featured the Buzzcocks' first ever gig with Howard Devoto and Pete Shelley, and half a guitar, Slaughter and the Dogs and the Sex Pistols. I'd seen other bands before, but that was the kind of moment when I realised that it was possible to stand on a stage. And there we go, the Pistols were magnificent.
That's one of the most famous gigs of all time, isn't it?
Well, they played two shows, I think. I went to the second one, and then later went to the Anarchy in the UK tour at in Manchester. They played, yeah. They came twice because the Anarchy tour got kind of cancelled all around the UK. So they played, yeah, 76. I was at that gig. But apparently, so was everybody else. So there must have been about 60,000 people there. But I can assure you there was only about, I don't know, 400 people max.
What Pistols track should we play? Pick one.
Play Anarchy in the UK, because they said that it's the first time they'd ever played it. And you can imagine Rotten, or Lydon, well, he was Johnny Rotten, he was kind of pretty antagonistic to a Manchester audience, being a Cockney, so it was kind of quite a night, yeah.
So when did ABC first come into existence then?
Round about the early 80s, It's a long history, isn't it?
Yeah.
I went and interviewed some guys, Mark White and Steve Singleton, and they had a band called Vice Versa, and I had a little fanzine that I'd called Modern Drugs, which was all about the stuff I liked. So I'd write about the pop group, and this is kind of 78, 79, I suppose. I loved the pop group and James Chance and the Contortions. I'm trying to think, the Human League, Cabaret Voltaire. So I'd write about these bands. And they said, join the band. So ABC formed shortly after that when... we'd kind of listened to a lot of James Brown and Chic and Earth, Wind & Fire, and we were listening to Joy Division and Cure, and we were trying to fuse the two worlds, and I started singing, I suppose. That's when ABC formed.
That's quite a diverse set of influences, isn't it, really?
Yeah, but back then, there was rock, and there was kind of R&B and dance music. It was kind of... Now, it's kind of all mixed up together, obviously. Then these days, you know, people work with about six or seven different genres, but back then... Yeah, there were different lines in the sand, and we wanted to blur those lines.
In terms of that first single, Tears Are Not Enough, that was like a top 40 hit when it came out in 1981. That's kind of pretty much straight out the traps, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
I mean, in terms of your memories of recording that song, was it a case of, you talk about trying to meld these different genres, were you happy with the way that you kind of achieved that? Because it's still quite a striking sounding track.
Yeah, we wanted to work with Alex Sakin, who'd done all the Grace Jones records and Sly and Robbie stuff, but I forget, he wasn't around. So we got together with a guy called Steve Brown, who'd done some stuff with, I think, The Cult. We went all the way down to London to Polygram Studios, Number One Marble Arch. And we'd made these incredible demos, but when we got in the studios, we were kind of baffled, really. It was a real struggle making that record. I remember the drummer at the time, Dave Robinson, locked himself in a room for 48 hours and wouldn't come out. So there was a lot of tension making that record.
Why?
So when it got to number 27 on the UK charts, we regarded that as a failure. I don't know, really. It was a terrible thing being an uptight, adolescent, want-to-rule-the-world sort of a guy in a band. But I think that's your birthright. I think everybody in a band... wants to do it that way.
Were you all very ambitious?
We were chasing our sort of dream of making a funky pop record, yeah. So Tears Not Enough, there's a lot of angst in that record.
Yes, you've shown your feelings. Yes, you've shown your tough. Said things worth believing. Tears are not enough. Tears are not enough. Tears are not enough. Yes, you've shown your feelings. Yes, you've shown your tough. Said things worth believing. We'll be right back.
And if we're going to talk about records sort of coming out that instantly make a statement, your first album, The Lexicon of Love, I mean, also your first number one, it's kind of generally regarded as like a perfect pop album. And normally bands take a while to kind of create something that's sort of regarded as a masterpiece. Can you remember recording it and thinking, this is special?
With The Lexicon of Love, we had a collection of songs. We'd heard Dollar, handheld in black and white, on the radio, and I remember Mark White said, we've got to check this guy, Trevor Horn, out. He's produced it. So we phoned him up and met him in Bayswater and told him our blueprint for success, basically. And Trevor, to his credit, believed us. Yeah, and he believed in us. Because let's face it, you know, we were just sort of four guys off the dole queue from Sheffield talking nonsense. But he heard Poison Arrow and The Look of Love and, I don't know, Date Stamp and All of My Heart and some of the songs, and you could see it. So we just set up. Recording The Lexicon of Love was an absolute joy. Yeah, it was all done beneath a wig shop on in a studio called Psalm East on Brick Lane. Yeah, a tiny, tiny studio which is still there. I saw it last week.
So when it came out, I mean, the reaction was just incredible. Were you kind of prepared for that amount of attention and fame? I mean, if you're very ambitious, maybe you were, but...
No, by ambitious, I mean, everybody's ambitious when they first kind of get a recording deal. You know what I mean? Everybody wants to rule the world. I'm joking about that. But, yeah, it was a very polished sound we were kind of chasing. We wanted to do it like Frank Sinatra, but with a sampling machine, you know, with the state-of-the-arts technology back then, in the early 80s. Mm. The record was made fairly quickly. People kind of think, because there's some pizzicato strings on there and some piano and pieces, we did take a long time, but stuff was happening all the time, so it was a kind of very fast recording process, yeah. There was one moment when we went to Abbey Road Studios and put orchestration on All of My Heart, and at that point I thought, yeah, we're getting somewhere here, you know. You've got to go on your instincts, and if the hairs on the back of your neck kind of stand up, you kind of think, okay, we're getting somewhere here.
Once upon a time when we were friends, I gave you my heart, the story ends. No happy ever after, now we're friends. Wish upon a star if that might help.
The stars collide if you decide.
Wish upon my heart. Stealing up in silk and coffee lace, you hooked me up, I rendezvous at your place. Your lipstick and your lip gloss seals my fate. Of my heart.
my heart.
You're listening to The First Time here on 6 Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Martin Fry from ABC. And that was All of My Heart by that very band.
6 Music.
6.
Everett, welcome back to The First Time here on 6 Music. And as we're celebrating the musical culture of Sheffield this weekend, fittingly my guest today is Martin Fry, frontman with the city's 80s pop maestros, ABC, talking us through the music that's defined his life. And that song was ABC's The Look of Love, taken from their 1981 debut classic album, Lexicon of Love. And it was that record, regarded as something of a classic of the era, that thrust ABC into the limelight. Now ask Martin how he and the rest of the band coped with their newfound fame at the time.
Well, we probably walked around the world antagonising people as much as we possibly could with our insanely over-obsessive demands, really, you know.
Like what?
To be honest, I don't know. We did once try and get all our roadies to wear tuxedos because we had tuxedos and they just weren't interested in that, you know, until we got to, like, Japan or somewhere, you know, we're playing the Budokan Stadium and they kind of got the tuxedos on by then. But by then, that was the end of the tour. Success handles you when it happens. Yeah, okay. The other way around. But I have to say, it was a lot of fun. But you know what? I think I enjoy it a lot more now, yeah. It's a bit like going on a school trip, you know, when you're really young.
Yeah.
We went to New York City and Andy Warhol came to the show and invited us all down to the factory, his place of work at the time, his studio. So, yeah, it was nuts. It was fantastic. And he was really fascinated as a filmmaker and obviously a world-renowned artist. He was kind of fascinated about how we'd done, like, the video to Poison Arrow or something, because MTV was just kind of exploding then anyway. Yeah, so that was the first time for that.
That's amazing. Another first we have to ask about is, when you first took delivery of your iconic gold lamé suit.
Yeah. The rest of the guys in the band had a meeting with me, which was pretty ominous, and they said, you're the singer, you got to do something about your clothes, mate, you know, and I got, like, my vintage stuff, and they said, there's a guy called Colin Wilde on Carnaby Street who's made some clothes for Mark Bolan of T-Rex fame. So we went down Carnaby Street and met this guy who was an ex-Pans People dancer, Colin Wilde.
Right.
God bless him. And he made this gold lamé suit. So conceptually that works, but I mean, imagine wearing it. You know, you're walking through Coventry on a wet Tuesday afternoon to do something. Yeah, people didn't always take it as, you know, it was our kind of vision of a Hollywood and an aspirational vision that didn't always work, as I say, on a wet Tuesday afternoon, you know. People go, why are you wearing that gold suit, son? So after that, playing on stage in front of thousands of people was pretty straightforward, yeah. Yeah, I did try and flush that gold suit down the loo.
Just got sick of it.
In the Kia Plaza Hotel in Tokyo, yeah, I got sick. Well, not so much sick of it, but you know when you go to a city and you've got a suitcase and you want to buy a load of stuff and take it home, you've got to take some stuff out of your bag, like a T-shirt or some old jeans you never wear. So with me, I just left the suit there, yeah. But I have had many gold suits since, I have to say.
Pounds. Dollar. Millionaire.
Dollar.
Pound.
Dollar.
Because I was looking at the video for How to Be a Zillionaire. Actually, it wasn't a video, it was a performance on the Tube.
Yeah.
How to Be a Zillionaire. And the band looked remarkable. Someone had commented, this band looked like they're from the future, still. And you were stylistically right out there.
At the time, it was nice when Delight came along with their kind of thing, and Gorillaz had a kind of whole animated cartoon look. With How to Be a Millionaire, we wanted to kind of destroy the image of the band as gold suits and tuxedos and Lexicon of Love and start again from scratch. So we kind of made a cartoon and we wanted to look as much like cartoon characters as possible. So much so that we made like fiberglass keyboards and fake guitar amps and stuff.
Right.
So when we got to do The Tube, which was performed live, most people hated it. They didn't really want us on the show, actually. We got chucked off a few kids' shows, you know, those pop shows.
Yeah.
But it was definitely... It was Andy Warhol, you know, it was definitely about kind of the idea of being successful and then just recreate yourself and reinvent yourself. That was definitely what we were doing visually, yeah. So, yeah, Millionaire, yeah. The other thing was the record company at the time, I remember walking in, there was a big poster on the wall and the record company had defaced it themselves, which is kind of rare, next to the Tears for Fears poster and the, you know, Curiosity Killed the Cat poster. It was kind of like, oh, okay, you know. But fortunately, like the cavalry coming over the hill, How to Be a Millionaire and Be Near Me were big top five hits in the United States of America. And I have to say, the USA took us to their collective bosom. Yeah, they like that whole thing, the cartoon thing.
Thank you.
I have to ask a serious question. When did you first realise that you were suffering from Hodgkin's lymphoma? Because obviously that's an enormous shock for anyone to take.
It was the same time, actually. When I was 27, I felt really tired. And we were touring in America. I was diagnosed with lymphoma, with Hodgkin's disease, like a strain of cancer, So I remember Tina Turner said, would you kind of come on tour with her? She was massive at the time, Tina Turner. She'd kind of travel the world. And ABC, as in the How to Be a Millionaire sort of period, we're going to go out on the road with her, but we couldn't do it, unfortunately, down to my ill health. It's a kind of twin-edged sword because, it was tough having a record in the charts and wanting to do all those incredible adventures in music, but not being able to do it through ill health. So I had chemotherapy and radiotherapy and various operations in Sheffield and then in London through 86, 87.
Was there a point when you didn't think you were going to make it?
Definitely. Yeah, because you don't know what's around the corner. You're sitting in a room talking to a guy, like a doctor, and then the ceiling comes in on you, and you think, what am I going to do? You know, what's this? When he's telling you, he's diagnosing you. But at the same time, I was quick to kind of respond to treatment, and in a way, for years I thought that was a curse, but in a way I think it's a blessing in a way, you know, that I was able to kind of just jump on that horse and get well. Once I did get strong enough, we kind of set about writing some more songs, and we had hits with When Smokey Sings and Night You Murdered Love. So in a way, it was kind of, I don't know, sweeter second time around, or third time around then, yeah.
You just mentioned When Smokey Sings. I mean, if you're going to make a comeback, have a comeback with a really big single. A first would be, when did you first hear the music of Smokey Robinson?
Cheadle Hume Youth Club, soul sort of weekender, I guess.
Yeah.
I think that's where I would have heard Going to a Go-Go but we used to listen to a lot of stuff from Atlantic and Stax, and a lot of Sly Stone, stuff like that. But the beautiful thing was, we'd made the record When Smokey Sings, which is kind of about Motown and, mm-hmm. and his him. And we went to Holland, and he's in the dressing room next door. So I knocked on the door and said, "Hey, hello, Mr. William Smokey Robinson. Here's a record all about you." So a couple of weeks later, we went to Los Angeles, and he met us there and took us out for dinner. Yeah, the record had become a hit, and his record was on the charts in America. So he's such a classy guy, Smokey Robinson, I have to say. He sent me a handwritten letter, and one to Mark White. We'd both written the song together. And he just said how touched he was and pleased he was. And at the bottom, it just says, Tamla Motown Division, director, or chairman, William S. Smokey Robinson. Yeah.
My Lord, what Smokey tracks should we play?
Everybody knows Going to a Go-Go and Tracks of My Tears and Tears of a Clown, but I do love a song called I Don't Blame You At All, 'cause you played it cool. I think it's called I Don't Blame You At All, yeah.
So moving on, you kind of called time on ABC as a kind of name in 92, but then resuscitated them again in 97. Was it a case of, like, there is unfinished business here, or has enough time passed for us to sort of reappreciate it again?
You reach a point in the 90s where you're just a man out of time. You know, that's going to happen to any of today's bands. Your time moves on, it evolves. We'd had 10 years of just kind of trying to crash the charts, you know, so it was definitely time. And the way I always saw it was, it's time to sort of finish going to Spectrum and Shoom and the Hacienda, and I bought some tools and had some kids and started going to make flat pack furniture work in my house and kind of go to all those other celebrated DIY stores. So I look in my wallet and I used to have like a Hacienda card, and then I've got like a Homebase card. And, you know, I'm thinking, yeah, what's got, you know, what's going on? But I did, you know, two beautiful children, Nancy and Louis, were born in 1991. So, yeah, your life evolves, it changes. But I must admit, the call of music did, yeah, kind of resurface. And around about 97, I got a call. Somebody said, you know, why don't you kind of climb on stage again? But the world was a totally different place. But it was fascinating to kind of go and play all around the UK. You know, that's just kind of a hoop of fire every band goes through. You know, even someone like the Stone Roses have just done that. Mm. You know, there's a point you reach where you don't become an elder statesman of pop or rock, but there's a point you reach where you kind of... You stand on a stage, you look out, and you realise there is a whole audience that does love your songs, you know, and you don't even know that sometimes. A lot of artists don't know that about themselves, but, you know, if I went to see David Bowie, I'd love him to perform Starman. He might think of that as just a song from way back when, but every artist has that. So it's the same with ABC. But the last 10, 12 years, yeah, I've been playing live all over the world, yeah.
And you received an honorary doctorate from the University of Sheffield. If you want to talk about being accepted as part of, like, yeah, and love, that's an honour, isn't it?
Yeah, Sheffield University contacted me, and I was, yeah, total honour. A doctorate of music means I can put Demas behind my name, like Chakademus and Plias. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
But I can do that. So does it mean I get a restaurant table by the window, perhaps?
Yeah, I can, totally.
A phone through. But now it was a great honour, and I did get to put on a mortarboard and all the kit and make a speech on my graduation to an audience of 21-year-olds. Back in the day, the band evolved out of all those rehearsal rooms and you know, competing with bands like Cabaret Voltaire and Clock DVA and I'm So Hollow and The Human League. There was a whole culture of bands when I came through, so it was a great honour to be to have that accolade. Yeah.
Take time to see.
And now, to celebrate 30 years since the release of the album we were talking about earlier, The Lexicon of Love, a pop masterpiece, you're going to perform the whole thing again. Now, you did this once in 2009, and you're not just performing, it's going to be a big production, this, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, December the 18th, we play the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane in London, with a full orchestra, with the South Bank Symphonia. And Anne Dudley, the original string arranger from The Lexicon of Love, is coming down.
Amazing.
To conduct it. It kind of worked really well a couple of years back, so it just felt right 30 years down the line to do that again. So
it must be really nice having an album like that that still, regardless of, as you say, genres and styles changing, it's still seen as one of these beautiful pop records that's kind of beautifully produced and just, it's kind of timeless in a way, I guess.
Well, for me to stand on stage and do my part, to collaborate with maybe 60 different musicians, yeah, that's something else to stand on. You can feel the air moving when people are playing the violins and cellos and stuff.
And the very last question, which is the same we ask everybody, we get them to choose the last song we play. Now, it can be anything of yours, anything of someone else's, something new, something old, anything you want, or something you just heard this morning and you liked. It's your choice to finish the show.
Song I just heard that I really like is Everything Everything, Cuff Cuff.
Why that track?
Because I bought the first record and I really liked it. I like things that you've got to peel open. I like music that sounds different every time you play it. And they're a kind of band that seem to do that. And I like to see that spirit is still alive today with the contemporary bands. So, yeah, Everything, Everything.
Sir, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Wait a second. Wait a second.
Wait a second.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Music Jukebox.
The king and give the queen everything.